For 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it. And I'm proud to have done it.
So the checks and balances, which have been so critical to preserving our constitutional system and individual liberties, largely don't exist now. My concern is that in the past decade, this Supreme Court has been less faithful to those principles than we would like. And that's dangerous for a democracy. This book tells the story of so many people, that people see their own lives in my book.
This is The Loaf Podcast. Today, we're incredibly lucky to be interviewing Judge Tatel, a recently retired United States Circuit judge who has recently written a memoir, Vision, a memoir of blindness and justice, reflecting on the state of US law today, his impressive career fighting for the protection of the American Constitution, the implementation of race and gender-based equality following the civil rights movement, and discussing the challenges of his blindness and how this has impacted his worldview and legal practice. A quote he puts in his book, which I think really sums up his perspective and what we're going to be talking about today, is from Barack Obama, the recent president. If you give up on the idea that your voice can make a difference, then other voices will fill the void. Judge Tatel, thank you so much for coming on. We ask all our guests at the beginning of our interviews, when is the last time you changed your mind on something important?
That's a great question.
Thank you.
I realized 48 hours ago in the United States that I completely misunderstood where our citizens were in the result of the election. I was completely surprised at the result. I was completely wrong. So.
Yeah. My personal opinion, in fairness, was that it could have gone either way. But I think the extent to which Trump won, just in terms of the number of jurisdictions, was, I think, way more of a sweepstake than I thought. But I don't know where you sat on that, if you had more confidence in a clear Kamala win or...
No, I didn't think it would be close. First of all, I'm not an expert on this. I read the same newspapers you do, probably. I assumed that it would be critical. It would be close, and I thought she would win. And my worry was violence and huge amount of litigation. None of that turned out. And to me, what's most surprising about what happened is that the now president-elect not only won the popular vote, which was quite surprising, but he, according to the election maps, he did better virtually everywhere in the country than he did last time. And here's the other thing that deeply worries me. We're not yet sure who will control the House, but it looks like the Republicans will. And so we'll have a situation where we have a president who is, how should we say it, less committed to our constitutional system than we would like, in a situation where all three branches of government are controlled by the Republicans and where the Supreme Court majority is sympathetic to him. So the checks and balances, which have been so critical to preserving our constitutional system and individual liberties in this constitution, largely don't exist now. The separation, the checks and balances are deeply frayed. So that's what scares me the most.
Well, that's brilliant, because that leads into what we wanted to begin to talk to you about. Before I do that, some context for our listeners. The theory of checks and balances was implemented by Montesquieu and was then put into place in the American Constitution. And the idea was that the different parts of the governmental system would counterbalance each other, such that the judiciary, were a president to become despotic and so on, would be able to counterbalance that through their legal practice. And as we've seen, Trump has, let's say, some power or some favor in the Supreme Court. And you write about that in your book, that you think the way that these justices go about it is problematic. Could you tell us a little bit about why you think that?
Yes, but first I want to say I appreciate your taking credit for our system. You are, of course, historically correct. but also, yes, the various branches, the reason we have three branches is that the framers of the Constitution wanted it to be difficult for the government to act. And they wanted to force the government to be able to act together. And my favorite description of what they had in mind is from Justice Brandeis, who talked about the, quote, friction, close quote, between the branches of government. He referred to it as friction, which slows the process down and presumably forces serious talk and contemplation. So that's how that works. My worry about our current Supreme Court is that over the decades and even centuries, our Supreme Court has developed a series of principles of judicial restraint, which are designed to confine the courts to the judicial process and keep them from interfering or meddling in the policymaking, legislative functions of government. In other words, to protect the checks and balances. Things like faithfulness to the Constitution, faithfulness to statutory text, following precedent, respecting the narrow, limited jurisdiction of courts. All of these are designed to keep the courts focused on the judicial function and not interfere with the legislative or executive functions. And my concern is that in the past decade, this Supreme Court has been less faithful to those principles than we would like, and that it has slowly, over a period of time, sort of 5-4 decision by 5-4 decision, or maybe now 6-3 decision by 6-3 decision, steadily increased its own power at the expense of the two political branches of government. And that's dangerous for a democracy.
Want your head and hair to feel cool and clean? Been going to extreme measures to cool your head off? Then get yourself a Manscaped. Don't be like Ollie and take your scalp from zero to hero with the new Scalp Buffer now. Use the discount code LOAF to get your 20% off.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Tatel. I think this might link a little bit to what you talk about in your book, Vision. And I'm just going to quote a little section of that book. And maybe you can elucidate that quote a little bit for our listeners. And off the back of that, we can maybe get into a little bit of a discussion about maybe your experience as well. So in the book you write, "It was one thing to follow rulings I believe were wrong when they resulted from a judicial process I respected. It was quite another to be bound by the decisions of an institution I barely recognized." Could you maybe expand on that a little bit? And off the back of that, tell us about the stare decisis principle.
Sure. Well, you've asked two different questions there. Let me answer your question about the quote from the book. That sentence is in a paragraph which explains why, after 30 years on the court, I decided to retire.
Sure.
And I made that decision for lots of reasons. And the sentence you quoted was just one of the reasons. And what I was getting at there was that, you know, the court I served on is an appeals court, and our decisions are reviewed by the Supreme Court. And the decisions we issue are sometimes reversed by the Supreme Court. And the point I was making there is that for maybe the first two-thirds of my career as a judge, you know, if the Supreme Court disagreed with me in a case, that was okay. It's the higher court. That's its job. And as long as it's applying the same rules I am, following statutes and precedent, if it reads them differently than I do, that's fine with me. And as a lower federal court judge, I'm bound by those decisions. My concern in recent years is that by the Supreme Court abandoning principles of judicial restraint that I think are critical to judging, It has produced opinions that not only I don't agree with, but I think are flawed from the point of view of proper judging. And to make matters worse, many of these opinions in the area of the environment and voting are having potentially quite serious consequences on the government. So here I was, a lower federal court judge, obligated to follow these opinions. And as they became more and more unprincipled, I became more and more uncomfortable applying them. And since I was obligated to, I really had no choice but to resign. Now, you ask about stare decisis.
Sorry, I kind of butchered the pronunciation of that as well.
So stare decisis is Latin for the principle in the U.S. courts that courts are bound by prior case decisions, prior decisions. Obviously, they can be overturned under limited circumstances, but the stability of the law, the consistency requires that courts follow precedent. Each decision of a court is a statement of the law, and that law needs to be followed by future courts. So it's critical to the stability of the system. There's another reason why following precedent is important, is that when you have a Supreme Court or a lower federal court, say composed of judges who are, just take for example, the majority is example appointed by Democratic presidents, following a decision issued by judges who are a majority of which are appointed by Republicans, it sends a powerful signal to the public that this isn't politics, that judging is something different from politics, and that the judges are applying objective law to facts before them. So following precedent is critical to the rule of law in our system. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be overruled, and it is from time to time overruled, but it can only be done when there are solid principled reasons for doing it and when those reasons are clearly articulated by the court.
Thank you. Yeah, definitely. I think this principle really, it's overturning. For example, in the case of Roe v. Wade and also with religious freedom and expression of speech, has been very, very relevant recently. We're about to get into one of those examples, but before I do, I just want to give a little bit of theory for our listeners and then maybe get your perspective on it. There's different approaches to how we approach the Constitution also, as well as how we approach legal practice and interpretation of the past in general. We have the approach of justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for example, often called living constitutionalism, which tries to get into the minds of those who wrote and really emphasize the spirit of the Constitution as opposed to reading it super strictly. And textualists or originalists read more strictly in exactly how it was implemented at the time. Now, I think the problem is that, for example, with the case of a religious person not serving a gay couple making cakes for their marriage, which was an important Supreme Court case about religious freedom and speech. I believe that to a certain extent, the decision was justified on a textualist perspective in the original Constitution about religious freedom and so on. Do you think this kind of textualist approach is problematic? And how do you think it impacts the way we do justice at the highest level?
I don't mean to duck your question, but I'm going to, because, I want to talk about, if it's okay with you, what my book is about. And
sure.
And on a court of appeals, yes, once in a while we have a case that's a pure interpretation of the Constitution. But most of the time on my court, yes, we're interpreting the Constitution, but we're also interpreting it in light of pre-existing Supreme Court and Court of Appeals decisions. And so that's what my book is about. And, Supreme Court justices and law professors can engage in this debate about originalism versus non-originalism. It's not something that has really impacted my career as a judge very much. I mean, I'll give you an example. We had a case many years ago where the question was whether or not the due process clause of the Constitution required the Food and Drug Administration to make drugs that hadn't yet been approved available to people who were dying, who had no hope. And now you can debate that question. If all you're doing is looking at the language of the Constitution and trying to read what the framers said, then, you know, then you have a big debate about originalism versus the Ruth Bader Ginsburg view of it. But when we decided the case, what we were essentially doing was interpreting prior Supreme Court decisions about that clause in the Constitution. And we were bound by those decisions, properly so. And so our job was to understand and apply the Supreme Court decisions that had interpreted the 14th Amendment. So it's a very different job. Also, well, I'll just say one more thing. Let me maybe jump ahead a little bit. I talk in my book, I have a whole chapter about voting rights. It's called The Future of Democracy. And one of the cases I talk about, and maybe you'll get to this, but this relates to your question about originalism. One of the cases that I talk about is called Shelby County versus Holder. And it's the case in which the Supreme Court invalidated the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act, which are viewed as one of the most effective and powerful civil rights law ever passed. Now, they did it on a strictly party vote, 5-4, with the Republicans in the majority and the Democratic justices in the minority. I mention this because if a true originalist would have come out the other way in that case, because the 15th Amendment, which they were applying, was so crystal clear. But yet the originalists on the court didn't. And so I'm mentioning this because originalists are generally originalists when it produces the result they want. And when it doesn't, they find other ways to decide a case.
Definitely. We were actually just about to get into the Voting Rights Act. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you went about defending Article 5 in the Voting Rights Act, trying to push back a little bit, and maybe also your specific in-depth work in research on how even equality having been established within the frame of the law, we have to ensure that, as you do, for example, voting booths aren't moved and all these sorts of things, which are really require a close attention to detail, which I think people don't realize when they're legislating so widely.
So could I give your listeners a little background?
Of course, sure.
Okay. It's all about the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which was added to our Constitution after the Civil War to protect the voting rights of the freed slaves. That's what the 15th Amendment is for. It's very short. And the first clause of the 15th Amendment says states can't discriminate on the basis of race. And the second clause, and that's the one I want to talk about, says Congress shall have the authority to implement this through, quote, appropriate legislation. Now, that brought about a dramatic change in the relationship between the federal government and the states. Up until the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the federal government had very limited authority, and this amendment shifted power to the Congress to rid the country of racial discrimination on the basis of voting. And so, acting pursuant to the 15th Amendment, in 1965, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, which had many provisions. And the one I think you mentioned is Section 5. And Section 5 said that certain southern states with a history of racial discrimination in voting, could not change any aspect of their electoral system. They couldn't change a voting district line. They couldn't even move a polling place without going to the Attorney General in Washington and proving that it was not discriminatory. And this law was dramatically effective in the South. And it was sustained, its constitutionality was sustained by the Supreme Court four times. Originally when the Congress passed it, and then three more times when Congress extended it. And it did so on the grounds that Section 2 of the 15th Amendment gave Congress all the power it needed over the states to prevent them from discriminating on the basis of race. So in 20 years ago, the Congress extends the Voting Rights Act again. And this time, the current Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, on a 5-4 vote, declares it unconstitutional. And they did so by using a principle, a court-made principle called equal state sovereignty. That is, that the states have to be treated equally. And because, you know, what the Voting Rights Act did was it applied this preclearance only to certain states. So the court said that's not treating states equally. Now, the problem with that is, first of all, it's a made-up principle. It's not in the Constitution. And secondly, the court's own precedent said that this doctrine only applies to the admission of states to the union, not afterwards. So the court took a made-up principle that its own precedent said did not apply to the current situation, and used it to override the very clear language of Section 2 of the 15th Amendment. So when you read, if you read the very first few Supreme Court opinions sustaining the constitutionality of Section 5, you'll read all about the evils of discrimination in voting based on race. That's what the court's talking about. If you read Shelby County, there's hardly any mention of that at all. And instead, it's all about state autonomy and protecting the freedom of states to change their voting laws. So the court in this case was, that's why I say that an originalist would have come out the other way. There's almost, I can't think of a provision of the Constitution that's clearer than Section 2 of the 15th Amendment. Congress shall have the authority to enforce it through appropriate legislation. This isn't like Dobbs, the abortion case, where there was some debate about the underlying constitutional provision. Here, it's crystal clear in just, I don't know, 14, 16 words. Yet this court found a way to basically disregard it.
Mm. Could you maybe, just for our listeners, briefly expand a little bit more on originalism, just so that some people who might not have that theoretical background get a bit more clued up on it?
Well, take this case. An originalist looks at the plain language of the Constitution.
Okay.
And applies that. Now, this is the 15th Amendment. It's part of the Constitution. And it's very clear that Congress has this authority. And the other aspect of this is that previous Supreme Court decisions made it very clear that when it comes to voting and race, the courts owe a huge amount of deference to Congress because of the 15th Amendment. And the Supreme Court ignored all that. So that's why I say an originalist would have come out the other way.
Thank you. I'll move it again back to your book. I think you write, optimism that racism is nearly over seems like a national pastime. That was one that stood out to us quite a lot. Could you, since we're discussing desegregation overall, could you maybe expand on your personal experiences and tell us about your work with the Office for Civil Rights and how you implemented desegregation?
Yeah. So I was the director of the Office for Civil Rights at the beginning of the Carter administration. And we enforced what is called Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibited racial discrimination in programs that received federal funds. And that's basically every school district and university in the country. I had that job in the mid-1970s, and OCR then was basically responsible for enforcing the requirements of Brown versus Board of Education. That's the famous 1954 Supreme Court decision that struck down separate but equal in schools. And so we were using the leverage we had with school systems to force or to require them to desegregate. And then later, the desegregation movement moved to the North and the West. These were school systems that hadn't been illegally segregated, but were nonetheless racially segregated because of demographics. And there were major efforts, and I worked on some of them, to desegregate those school systems, including by involving the predominantly white suburbs in the effort. But by that time, the three branches of government, the courts, the Congress, and the president, that had uniformly worked together to require desegregation in the 50s and 60s and 70s, those three branches of government were now opposing or making desegregation efforts more difficult. So the United States, four-decade experiment with school desegregation reached its peak in the 1980s and then declined. And in most big school systems now, the segregation is just as bad as it was at the beginning.
Yeah, what's maybe the personal kind of feeling that you have about that? Clearly something that you are very linked to throughout your life, or what relevance is up to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm disappointed. I believed in equal educational opportunity and that that's best achieved in desegregated school systems. And the research on education proves that I'm correct about that. Desegregated education is good for Black and white students. But Americans' attitudes towards this have changed. That's the quote you read from my book. People are tired of civil rights. White people think, we've dealt with this issue long enough. There isn't much discrimination anymore, and forcing people to get on buses to go to school is a bad idea. So the country has walked away from that, starting with Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon ran in 1968. He ran for election on the basis of what he called his Southern strategy, which was anti-busing, and it paid off big time for Richard Nixon. That's largely what got him elected. And that began the dramatic change in the public attitude towards civil rights and desegregation in our country.
Yeah, what I really get from this example, actually, is how even with what we would see as the right legislation being in place, so with the General Civil Rights Act, we had desegregation effectively put in place or made law, and yet nonetheless, based on funding, attention to detail, which political administration is in place, these can be implemented more or less. So maybe you could expand on, in general, from your experience in this case from the book, how important correct implementation and attention to detail is, and making sure that we actually implement what we put into law.
Yeah, I mean, you've made a very important point. It's absolutely critical. I mean, when I was the director of the Office of Civil Rights, I was enforcing Title VI according to what the courts required. And 20 years later, under Republican administrations, they were interpreting Title VI far more narrowly. And the courts had narrowed and limited Title VI. So, yes, you can have a constitutional provision or a statute that's on the books, but it can be interpreted differently by different courts and implemented differently by different administrations.
Right.
And that's, particularly with respect to the latter part of it, that's why we have elections, right? That's what a democracy is. It's not bad that a Republican administration interpreted Title VI more narrowly than I did. That's what democracies are for. Now, I didn't agree with it, but that's how our system works.
Yeah, just on the topic of elections, and also maybe the slight subjective element of judging, I was wondering how much power you believe the judiciary and public legal officials should have in general. In your book, you compare kind of judging to the scientific method. Some people might argue that judges are not elected.
Well, judges are not elected, and that's one of the reasons why it's so important for courts to follow principles of judicial restraint. If the American public doesn't like what the Senate, the bills as Congress has passed, they can vote against them and remove them from office. You can't do that. In the U.S., in our Constitution, federal judges are appointed for life. And so where does their accountability come from? Their accountability comes from faithfulness to the Constitution and the laws that Congress passed. And it also comes from writing opinions that explain to the public that that these decisions rest on legal principles, not personal policy principles. That's the critical difference in our separation of powers between the three branches of government. The courts are not elected. They're appointed for life.
The pertinent example for me from that actually is you say in your book, I'm against the death penalty. However, if I believe that the use of the death penalty is defensible in this case on the basis of the text, then that is the decision you will put in place. As you emphasize with the analogy of the scientific method. Yeah, with the aforementioned example of the Voting Rights Act, you did your best to make it difficult for the Supreme Court to overrule Article 5, even though you didn't directly oppose it. So where is the place for morality in the legal profession? Linking back to the political question, it seems like we got a little bit of movement within still quite a strict interpretative work.
Judges apply the law. That's what they do. They apply the law that Congress passes. Or the Constitution. That's their job. Their job isn't to produce a result that the judge thinks is right as a matter of policy or even just. The judge's job is to apply the law that Congress passes to the facts before him. That's it. Now, a lot of people think, well, you should be producing results that are morally right. Well, that's not my job. Congress is the one that passes the laws, and they're politically accountable for them. My job as a judge is to apply those statutes. Now, I do it by trying to understand what the Congress was intending. So, one of the cases I talk about in the book is a Supreme Court decision. It's called Cummings, and it involved a woman who was trying to get she was deaf. An interpreter in a federally funded program, and they denied it, and she sued, and the Supreme Court ruled against her because it said it's not fair to the employer to make him pay for emotional damages to this woman. The employer never expected that. What's wrong with that decision is that the disability law that was in place, Congress passed that to protect people with disabilities and to give them a remedy for being discriminated against. And that was the purpose of the statute. That's the job of the judge, is to apply the statute according to the Congress's purpose, not to produce what you call the moral result. That's up to Congress.
But clearly you would perhaps agree that there is often, as we've discussed, the level of interpretation.
Of course.
So when you're kind of in that seat making those decisions, and you need to make that interpretation, do you try bring in some sort of objectivity, or do you try bring in some sort of your own sense of morality as well?
No, I don't bring in my own sense of morality. I try to understand what the language of the statute means and what Congress intended by passing it. That's my job. That's my only job as a judge. It isn't to produce a result that I like. And by the way, I talk about this. I give some examples of this in the book where I wrote opinions that produce results that, you know, had I been in Congress or on the agency, I would have voted the other way.
One example where you didn't necessarily disagree, but where you trying to fill in the purpose of the legislation was with your decision, perhaps in an area which you're most famous for, which is on the environment and the Clean Air Act. And you interpreted the purpose of it as to the Clean Air Act stating that companies could only produce X amount of whatever chemical. You made a decision that companies shouldn't be allowed to produce any, or you agreed with the decision that companies shouldn't be allowed to produce any of a certain chemical. This was an important ruling, right? But you interpreted it purely on the basis of what you thought the legislation was trying to do, regardless of how it might be put across.
Yeah. I think the case you're talking about is Massachusetts versus EPA. And the question in that case was whether the agency, the EPA, had to regulate carbon dioxide. You know, carbon dioxide is the chemical that is most responsible for global warming, or is responsible along with other chemicals for it. And the Bush administration took the position that carbon dioxide wasn't a pollutant, and that even if it was, they didn't have to regulate it because they could deal with it through other techniques. And I looked at the Clean Air Act and the definition of pollution, and it seemed to me quite clear that carbon dioxide was a pollutant under the statute. I didn't reach that decision because I thought it was necessary to regulate carbon dioxide. I reached that decision because I concluded that that's what Congress had decided. And fortunately, the Supreme Court agreed with me 5-4.
When you think about the developments now of the environment in relation to the judiciary, now that Trump's been elected?
Well, I think there is cause for concern. Look, all we have to do is look back at the first Trump administration. I mean, we don't have to guess here. The first Trump administration rolled back hundreds of environmental regulations. And I have no reason to believe it won't do the same this time, perhaps even more significantly. We don't really have to guess about this.
Yeah, you spoke about your friendship in the book with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was very important in acting as a kind of check and balance, you say as well, in working against this kind of movement. Could you maybe talk about her role as well in relation to protecting legislation like this and her role in the Supreme Court before she unfortunately passed?
Well, you know, her view about the law was the same as mine, and that is that a judge's role is to apply the law that Congress has passed. You know, she was before she came on the court, she was one of the most important litigators in the United States on women's rights issues. She won several big cases in the Supreme Court, just like Justice Marshall did before he went on the court. I mean, she had a formidable civil rights record before she was on my court for 10 years and then the Supreme Court. In fact, when I was appointed to my court because she had been appointed by President Clinton to the Supreme Court, and I was appointed to fill her vacancy on my court. I mean, she was the same kind of judge I hope I was.
Thank you, Judge Tatel. I think if it's okay with you, we'll move the topic on a little bit. So this one's a bit more personal to you. I was wondering if you could maybe tell us about your process of coming to grips with disability and being blind.
Well, that's the other thread in the book. That's the other thread in the book, along with my views about the courts, is my personal history of dealing with declining sight. When I was 15 years old, I was diagnosed with an inherited retinal disease called retinitis pigmentosa. All I was told at the time was that I couldn't see very well at night at that point, but I was told that my sight would decline over years. No one knew how fast, and no one knew then whether I'd lose my sight. But in fact, that's what happened. Over the next 20 years, it declined steadily. And by my mid-30s, I couldn't read any longer. And I began to work with readers, and I tried to learn Braille, though not very successfully. And a few years after that, I got a mobility cane and used that for quite a long time. And then six years ago, I took the big step and got a guide dog. During most of that time, you know, when I was still functioning as a sighted person, as a teenager and a young lawyer, I had lots of tricks for covering up my declining sight. I didn't want people to know about it. I didn't talk about it. I hid it. And I tell all those stories in the book. Some of them are funny. Some of them aren't so funny. And then by the time I was it was obvious to people that I had a visual disability, especially because I had a cane. I still never wanted to talk about it. When I was on the court, I didn't want to be known as the blind judge. I wanted to be known as the judge who happened to be blind. So I tell the story in the book. I write extensively about this. Writing a memoir was a very personal experience and required me to think deeply about my life and how I reacted to declining sight. And I've tried to tell that story in the book.
One part that really struck me was you mentioning how in the past you even used to remove, for example, the mention of your blindness from Wikipedia so that you wouldn't right. be viewed in that light. And that's perhaps what meant that it took so long for you to begin using a cane for movement and eventually for getting a guide dog, your guide dog who you seem to love, a very beautiful dog, Vixen. Maybe you could tell us about the thought process behind becoming comfortable with it and integrating it into your public speech and your personality. What motivated the change?
Well, it was slowly coming over the years. But there were, I'd say, two things that really made the big difference. One was writing the book. Writing the book, when I started it, I didn't think I would produce a book like I ultimately did. But the more I wrote and the more my wife, Edie, and I, my wife is a fine writer and she worked on the book with me, which was especially wonderful because she's part of the story. But the more she and I talked about our lives together and how I dealt with, the more I began to understand it and the more I became comfortable with it. So writing the book was part of it. The other was getting a guide dog. When you're walking around with a mobility cane, people don't come up to you and ask you how it works or how do you get across the street with it. But when you have a guide dog, everybody wants to talk about the dog and how she works and what she does and can she get you across safely. And that experience walking around with a guide dog and talking to strangers about it made me much more comfortable with the whole thing. And now I enjoy talking about how I function with my dog. It gives me a lot of pleasure because she's given me so much independence.
Yeah, I think something that jumped out to me while preparing for this interview as well was the blind justice motif. And I think off the back of that, my question would be, do you think this current sentiment in America right now, the current feeling, the general opinion is that the judiciary is fair, is metaphorically blind?
Oh, I see your point. I see your point. All I can do is tell you what the polls show. And the polls show that respect for the courts has dropped dramatically in the past 10 to 15 years. Now, why is that? Well, I'm no expert on this, but, if you read what the experts write, they think it's because the courts have become so much more politicized in our country. They think it's because of the ethical issues surrounding the court. And my own view is it's also because the court itself has become political and therefore the public has less respect for it. And the polls are dramatic. So the polls are clear. You can't question that. The debate is why, and I just gave you the reasons why I think public respect for the courts has declined.
Definitely for me, not that I'm a US citizen, but I stay in touch with what's going on. Definitely for me, the thing that eroded my trust in the Supreme Court was in particular the case of overturning, to some extent, Roe v. Wade at the federal level. Maybe you could tell us about the problems with the way they dealt with that case and what it tells us about the justice system in that exact way of introducing personal viewpoint as opposed to blind interpretation.
Okay. So I don't talk about personal viewpoint in the book. I've stayed away from, I do not say a word about what's motivating the justices. My book is about the courts and the opinions they write. Judges have to explain themselves in opinions, and we can decide whether an opinion a court issues is an act of judging or not by reading it. And so if you take Dobbs, that's the case that overruled Roe v. Wade, you have to read it, you have to consider it in context. So candidate Trump said that if elected, he would get Roe v. Wade overturned. That's what he said when he was running for president. And he put out a list of judges who he would appoint. I don't remember. There were 10 or 12 judges on that list. And he said, I'm going to overrule Roe v. Wade, and here are the judges I'm going to appoint. He won. He appointed three of those judges, and they overturned Roe v. Wade. So just from the optics, you could forgive the public for thinking that this was a political act. So then you say, okay, well, let's go look at the Roe v. Wade decision. And I've read it several times. I don't find in there any persuasive reason why Dobbs should be, Roe should be overruled. In fact, 20 years earlier, the Supreme Court had reaffirmed Roe. But yet this court overruled it in an opinion which, I'm just speaking for myself, I found it unpersuasive. I didn't see anything in there that explained to me why it should be overruled. Nothing had changed since Roe v. Wade. The public attitude towards abortion was the same. The issues were the same. The only thing that changed was the judges on the Supreme Court.
Thank you. Let's return to your book in specifics before we wrap up shortly. You mentioned there are really two main threads, the opinions, how the legal system should be set up, and also, like we've just recently discussed, your journey with your blindness and being open about it and so on. Having discussed a lot about the opinions of judges, in particular justices, and your legal opinions as put out insofar as you are a judge, I'd like to return back to your ability to discuss disability and blindness. And you said that you want to be an advocate for demonstrating that people who do experience drawbacks, mitigating circumstances, disability, and so on, can go on and do great things. What else do you think needs to be done to help people do that beyond the great work that you're doing in talking and being open about
it? Well, thank you. I hope this book helps. I hope the book will be read by people who don't have disabilities, who hire lawyers or in corporations who hire people. I hope they'll read this book and realize that and understand that if they're interviewing three people and one of them is blind or has a disability, that they hire on the merits. I hope they'll take away from this book that blind people can function at the very highest levels. What else can be done? We have in the United States the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's a good statute. We just need to do a better job of enforcing it and a much better job of explaining to employers and others what their responsibilities are.
Thank you, Judge Tatel. First of all, we really appreciate your time joining us today.
Glad to talk to you.
We're going to link your book in the description below, Vision, a Memoir of Blindness and Justice. And everyone listening or watching should definitely go buy that, read it, and find out more about Judge Tatel. Maybe off the back of what we've discussed today, you could give some concluding thoughts to those watching.
Oh, yeah. I'll just say one thing. Yeah, let me conclude with this. I already mentioned to you that writing the book was a deeply personal adventure in self-reflection. And I came out of the process somewhat of a different person than when I started. But here's the other thing that was amazing to Edie, my wife, and me, which is the aftermath of the book. The book came out in early June. It's almost 6 months ago. And I get emails almost every day, sometimes more than one, or letters, or have a conversation from people who say, vision tells my story. And what I have come to understand is that lots of people who went through what I went through acted exactly the same way in terms of hiding their disability and not talking about it. It turns out to be that's what everybody did. And that's been very profound for me to realize that that this story tells, that this book tells the story of so many people, that people see their own lives in my book. That's very meaningful to me.
Judge Tatel, thank you for joining us on the Loaf Podcast today. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. I did too. Good question. Yeah.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks a bunch.
Nice to meet you both.
Nice to meet you.
Great to meet you. Great to meet you, Judge Tatel. We'll leave this episode here, and don't forget to check out the book in the description below. See you next time.